I am not Marshall McLuhan, in case anybody was wondering. And we've determined after sitting here for 10 minutes, we're definitely operating within a cool medium this morning. We'll try and heat it up a little bit for you later. This program is brought to you in living color without the sponsorship of the state of New York, as you may have read. In the catalog, it says that this is Communication Arts 141. It sounds like it's, you know, one more list, one more item in a catalog. The title is Understanding Media for obvious reasons. We'd like it to be something different than the appearance of a group of people or the man who have packaged ideas ready to hand out. A word which Dr. McLuhan and his associates have used for long years is the word explorations. And it's a word we like to hang with. We'd like to be dealing this year in problems which are hot, relevant, and unresolved, so that the conclusions we come to are not something that anybody who's standing up here necessarily arrived at by themselves, but conclusions that we've probed together, explored together, because the answers are not in yet. And this is a little bit sloppier format to work in than the old package theory of education, where we really go through the process of stenciling onto your brain things that we've already got stenciled onto our own brains. So what I'd like to do is just make a couple of housekeeping kind of announcements here today. In addition to the group in this course, there's also a smaller group of some 18 or 20 students whose full-time work in the first semester will be involved with the Schweitzer team. We'll meet this afternoon for a very brief meeting at 2 o'clock in the Little Theater. The next meeting and the subsequent meetings of this group will be in Keating 1, over in Keating 1. What I'd like to do is, what we're doing this morning is an old Jesuit tradition of Schola Brevis. The first day isn't as long as some of the other days. And I'd like to introduce not only Dr. McLuhan, but the two associates who will be working with us this year. As you saw by the New York Times yesterday or Saturday or whenever you read things, it's almost traditional now for a number of publications to refer to our age as the age of McLuhan. And it's a very rare thing indeed when one man can get brand name identification with either an age or an era. And we're kind of delighted that as part of a project we're referring to as Export 67, that we were able to bring him across state lines. As I left Toronto in December, I got to the counter there and where they want to look through your dirty underwear and see whether you've got the heroin, you know. And the fellow said, "Do you have anything to declare?" And I said, "Would you believe Marshall McLuhan, you know?" He's really, as you know, forced the whole generation of thinkers and people through his theories and stimulating ideas to pay attention to an area that they weren't paying very much attention to. And we're indeed honored that we can be part of this kind of thinking and action-oriented research this year. With Dr. McLuhan are Professor Harley Parker, who's a painter, a designer, a calligrapher, a typographer, and who'll be speaking briefly this morning, and Dr. Edmund Carpenter, who pulled the most dramatic advent of all by getting here like at 7:30 this morning after closing his house and school up in California last night. He's an anthropologist, very interested in primitive art, very interested in movie making, very interested in Eskimos. So if there are any Eskimos in the course, they've got it made already. Toward the end of the first couple of weeks, what we'd like to do is to consult your interests, find out the kind of ideas that you'd be interested in fooling around with more than any other kind of idea, and perhaps arrange that the third meeting of this group every week will either be, after the first 2 or 3 weeks, will either be a guest lecturer or a small seminar group of 15 people or so. So without much further ado, and we'll all say a few words, I'd like to introduce Fordham and Dr. McLuhan to each other, Marshall McLuhan, and Harley Parker is the one with the beard, and Ted Carpenter is the other one.
Oh. I find it all a little unreal, a little embarrassing, but we'll do our best to fight it off, hold it back. I hope one of the things you'll do for me this year is to research the joke, if you can find any. The joke, I'm very grateful to Steve Allen for having pointed out to me years ago, the funny man is a man with a grievance. And wherever you find jokes, sort of clustering and, generating in notable degree, you're going to find a grievance. The ethnic joke is such, you see, is an area of interface between one cultural group and another, and it produces endless grievances. Canada is loaded at present with French-Canadian jokes because French Canada and the rest of Canada have been interfacing and irritating each other over a long period, and it tends to get a little hotter from time to time and produces stories like the one about the mouse who was being pursued by a house cat, found a little hole in the floor and scampered under, and then after a while all was quiet, and then suddenly a kind of bow wow arf arf sound occurred, and the mouse figured the house dog has come along and scared the cat away. So the mouse popped up and the cat grabbed it, and as it chewed the mouse down it said, you know, it pays to be bilingual. And I could tell you some more of those French-Canadian grievance stories. Wherever you find jokes, you find grievances. So you can do some quite serious research in this area. You see, that's a nice example of how invisible the real environment always is. We do everything we can to hide from the present, because the present is an area in which we feel exposed and we're insecure and therefore somewhat unhappy. And we do everything possible to conceal the present from us. And this is true of men in all periods of human history. And they prefer to look in the rearview mirror. You feel safer back one age. This is just as true of Plato as it was of Shakespeare. And Shakespeare was a medievalist in his work. And Plato was very much devoted to the old primitive and integral order of tribal man behind him. And Bonanza is a nice example of where America prefers to live. Bonanza Land is one stage back, the frontier. And it's much safer than the present. But this tendency to always live back one stage puts one in a rather bad position, or the age in a rather bad position to do any serious navigating. We happen to live in a time of speeded up information. When the past, we can have access to the past so easily that there really isn't a past. It's all present. And the present has become so rich and so complex and terrifying that people do all they can to hide from it. But in the meantime, for example, the information environment, for example, yes, satellites, Telstar. What happened with Telstar was really rather amazing in ways that people haven't really noticed. When you put a man-made environment around the planet becomes an art form. Nature ceases to exist. Nature goes inside a man-made environment. With Telstar, with satellites, the natural world, the planet, our external habitat, has become the content of a man-made environment as much as any Hollywood set. There's no more nature. In the electric age, no more nature. The whole planet becomes programmed like a teaching machine. The whole human environment is now a teaching machine. James Joyce put it this way, he said, the herb, it orbs. The city becomes terrestrial in scope, and the planet in turn becomes a global village. It is reduced by the speed of communication. The space is reduced to almost nothing. Well, this kind of revolution is the one in which you're actually living, where all of us actually living, And it enables all sorts of things to appear and to be noticed for the first time that had previously been unobservable. But this principle that whenever a new technology develops, it creates a new environment for the whole culture, and that environment is totally invisible, this has always been true. And so you can do, nobody's ever studied this historically. It's a, I'll name a few other wide open fields of great magnitude that have never been touched by human scholarship. For example, at the present time, one of the effects of the speed up of information is to bring people so close together that the whole human family becomes a unitary in a new way, in a very conscious way. This is tribal. That is, when the whole of mankind becomes conscious of its very close dependence and interdependence, you are moving into tribal conditions of interface and dialogue. And the electric age that has been shaping us for the last few decades has been responded to by the teenagers, for example. I call it the TV generation. Those who learn to read and write before TV are a very different bunch from those who learn to read and write after TV. Why? Because reading and writing act as a buffer, a cushion against the X-ray effects of TV. TV is not a picture machine. These snapshots that are going on around us belong to the old technology. They're pictures, they're not X-ray. The new technology is X-ray. The kids who have been X-rayed from the cradle, as it were, go out into the world looking for depth or involvement. Their 21-year-old brothers and sisters are a completely different bunch from the 14, 15, 16-year-olds. Here's an area for research. Nobody's ever researched this, but it's wide open, and when people understand this generation gap is really a technological gap, it'll help them to get things into some sort of order again. But I just mentioned, mankind is under speeded-up conditions, retribalizing in the old technical sense. I'm using the word tribal now in the technical sense of living by ear rather than by eye. The word involvement has taken over from the word escapism. Everybody used to be accused of escapism in the age of the book and the movie, and now they're accused of involvement. The old meaning of cool was detachment. The new meaning is involved. The word cool has flipped. And it's a very good indication of where or what's been going on. But this retribalizing, which is a technical thing, and I am not taking a pro or con stand on this or on any of these other technical changes. It seems to me rather futile to make a moral stand or a value judgment stand on a technological matter. After all, technology is something we did to ourselves. Why become indignant or enthusiastic about a wheel or a telegraph? Another major shift going on right under our noses, and therefore invisible, is the shifting of the Western world toward the Orient. That is, we are engaged in westernizing the Orient by our old technology. This is called Vietnam. Sending the old technology to the Orient to westernize them. This is the military aspect of things as a teaching machine. The military services are teaching machines, and the whole nature of war as educational is one of the themes I think men have never studied. In war, a whole culture goes into action. It's not just specialism. Julius Caesar educated the Goths and the Huns very adequately. He really educated them. They quickly came back and destroyed him. Destroyed Rome. But Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar were the two of the greatest educators in the history of mankind. warfare as a teaching machine, warfare as the whole culture acting as a unified educational service, is never more evident than at the present moment. The educational activity going on in Vietnam is total. It's not specialist. They're not getting courses. They're getting our whole culture by interface. Now, this happened. Napoleon educated the Russians in Western ways, being far more than Peter the Great. And he taught them how to drive on the right side of the road all through Europe anyway. Does anybody happen to know whether the Russians drive on the right-hand side? I have the impression that Russians drive on the right. I do? Well, anyway, where Napoleon went, there were technological reasons for his, and military reasons, why he wanted the traffic on the right-hand side. He never got to England. They still drive on the left. Never got to Sweden. They're now spending billions putting the traffic on the right-hand side. But wherever Julius Caesar went, he taught them organization in the Roman visual bureaucratic style, and he laid out straight streets and so on. War is education. I think it, once people realized that war was a major all-out educational effort, they would quickly abandon it as disgusting. People aren't that fond of education. So war has been misclassified. It is actually a teaching machine. The whole culture in action simultaneously equals war. Education simply consists in putting one little bit of the culture in action in under controlled conditions, you know, algebra, arithmetic, history. You break it up, break your culture up into little bits, and just allow one little bit at a time, and that's education. War is the whole culture in action. Now, as I say, these are utterly unexplored, untouched subjects. While we are westernizing the East, the Orient, by our old technology, we're orientalizing ourselves by new technology. The electric age is giving us all the inner trip. We're spending all our latest billions on orientalizing the Western world by electric means, while spending a much smaller budget on westernizing the Orient. But again, anything that is present is invisible, and the fact that we're orientalizing ourselves, going inward, in depth, giving up all our old superficial ways of external aggression in favor of inner tripping, this is quite invisible. I don't know what would happen if people became totally aware of what they were doing in any particular period. I hope we may have something to contribute to this. Awareness, it seems to me, is a very desirable thing. I'm not sure if that's a moral judgment. No, it's just a preference. But I can assure you that history reveals that people have never in any age of the human past ever known what they were doing. That is, what the effects would be of what they were doing. They always had, you know, verbalized ways of mentioning to themselves what they were doing. But, for example, nobody ever knew what the effect of the wheel would be on the arrangement of human life and so on. And now in the age of the circuit, the wheel is finished. The motor car is on its very last wheels. You can tell that from all the disturbances and all the miseries created by congestion and density of traffic and so on. The motor car has just about had it in the age of the airplane and the capsule and so on, the wheel, and the age of the electric circuit. It's not a wheel at all. The motor car has had it. Oh, I don't care. That is, I don't hope this is true. I don't wish that it were otherwise, either, or either. One of the big differences between Canada and the States is that we say either, and we also say process. I think that's the main difference between Canada and the States. And And I have long ago accustomed myself to saying process, but which I find much easier to say. But I do slip on the either and neither from time to time. But these areas of complete numbness, any new technology creates an environment, it creates a total numbness in our senses because our instincts are to hide from that which is not known, that which is strange. And so people are always unaware of the new environment. And so they're unaware of the electric environment. All right, at the present, let's say so. At the present moment, the changes going on in the Negro world are very much tied up to electricity. Nobody knows this. That is, you put a total electric environment of information around a population, and the people who feel it most immediately are those who are closest to the ear world, the total world. The Negro lives a more integral life, a more unified life than the rest of the, I'm speaking now as populations, not individuals. The general population is more specialized, more fragmented. Now, the Negro is turned on by electricity. The old literacy never turned him on because it rejected him and degraded him. The old mechanical world rejected and degraded the Negro. But electricity turns him on and accepts him totally as an integral human being. Electricity is organic, it's not mechanical. And so the Negro feels that he owns the world under these conditions, as in a certain sense he does. The teeny boppers, likewise, they feel exactly the same way about electricity. It turns them on. Literacy doesn't turn them on. It's too specialized. It rejects them. But as soon as the Negro is turned on, he looks to the old technology that had rejected him with anger. The destruction that follows is symbolic. It's not to be measured by some kind of rationalistic method at all. It's the enemy. But I mention this as practical. I would have preferred, in a way, not to have got onto that subject, but I'm merely mentioning, since we're doing this to ourselves, we're creating these electric environments without knowing what they do to people at all, without knowing what the generation gap they create between child and parent. TV has created a huge gap between children and parents, between children and teachers. And nobody knows why. TV is an X-ray machine. It's not pictures. It's pure X-ray. The effect on the inner life of people is fantastic. It's an inner trip. The X-ray generation, since TV, completely different people from before TV. It has nothing to do with the programs they watch. It has to do with the profound experience of being X-rayed. And just totally in depth, so that every situation thereafter must have depth. So when the child goes to school after TV and sees the offerings, the little bit of this and the little bit of that, he's absolutely amazed to think that anything so feeble could coexist with anything so magnificent as TV. The outer environment is a great big teaching machine charged with messages, whereas the inner environment of the schoolroom is paltry, feeble, specialist, classified data, like looking up words in a dictionary. I mean, this is the kind of revolution we're living through, and the kind that we have made ourselves, made it to happen to ourselves. It is a happening. It's total. And I simply am suggesting that awareness as a strategy has something to be said for it, where awareness of the present, not the future, has a lot to be said for it in preference to our usual habit of looking in the rearview mirror. I think I've taken enough time, Father. And I want you to meet my colleagues at once. And I look forward to a very lively year. Thank you.
As Dr. McLuhan has shown, it is almost incumbent upon anyone beginning an address to tell a joke. Now, these jokes usually don't bear any relevancy whatsoever to what you're going to say later on. Now, I don't have a joke, but I have an anecdote. In Houston, Texas, on a corner drugstore, there is a sign in the window which says, "We dispense with accuracy." That has nothing at all to do with what I am going to say, I trust. As Father Culkin has mentioned, I am an artist. He failed to mention one thing, which is my current interest. And that is sound and light. Today is a method of entertainment. I'm interested in sharpening that tool to make it into a tool for education. Now, I'm particularly interested. I have worked in museums for the last 10 years, and I think it's possible, barely possible, to rejuvenate the museum world. So, I have intentions of moving into this area. In a few weeks, I am producing in the Museum of the City of New York a show which I regard as an orientation gallery to the New Amsterdam galleries there. I'd like to describe that briefly. I'm using four projectors simultaneously, showing art of the period, landscape of the period, costume, so on, simultaneously. Over the top of it, I'm using a revolving projector, which will show contemporary New York, backed up by two tape recorders, which will use, first of all, Tony Schwartz's New York 19, which is largely concerned with children's games on the streets of New York, and also 16th century music. This to go on all very quickly. Another project is the Museum of Modern Art, in which I have promised to give a 20-minute history of painting, poetry, and music. It's quite possible. See, because I believe this, that in our society, we fragment art off from other activities all the time. I know my daughter used to have art every Thursday morning at 11:30 till 12:10. Now, I believe that art as such is a way of living, it's a way of seeing, it's a way of knowing. If it has any function at all, it must be pervasive right through the entire educational curriculum. I believe that this pattern, this light show, like the sound show, is an iconic thing. That is, it deals with times, spaces, sounds simultaneously, to be able to be grasped from many points of view simultaneously, not from any one given position. And I think that the iconic is particularly applicable today because under the impact of electronic media, this is what is happening to our world. We are being bombarded constantly, from side to side, by all kinds of diverse data, which we have to form not into a lineal and sequential development, but into a broad pattern recognition of what is happening to us. Marshall McLuhan and I have in the press right now in Harper and Row a book called Through the Vanishing Point, in which we are concerned with concepts of space in poetry and painting, starting with the cavemen and moving right up to the present. And we, I think, in this book demonstrate that all preliterate societies do deal with the iconic. They do deal with multi-times and multi-spaces simultaneously in their presentations or in their image-making. But starting with the Greeks, developed in the Romans, tending to fade out in the Middle Ages, and coming up once more into the Renaissance, is the illustrative. Now, the illustrative is one time, one space, from one point of view. Think of your Renaissance paintings. This is what they are. Whereas the icon deals, as I said, with many times, many spaces, from many points of view simultaneously. And I think that this is the world we have re-entered. I think that that's all I want to say.
I'd like to suggest very strongly, if you didn't see Saturday's New York Times, there was an excellent piece by Grace Glick on the whole multimedia thing, and Harley's work at the Royal Ontario Museum is one of the great museum things that's been done on this continent. And it'd be a good introduction. I recommend strongly you read it before we meet the next time. It's an extensive article. It talks about all of the people that are working in the mixed media, cross media, media mix kind of field. It was Saturday on page 1, section 2 of the NYT. Ted, will you join the group here? Ted has had 58 minutes sleep, so...
let me make a few very casual remarks. I'm an anthropologist, and my interest is in tribal groups. I know when I was a child, I read Alice in Wonderland and was enormously impressed. And then I read Freud, and I found this more interesting because it was real people, sometimes deranged, but real. And then I encountered anthropology, and that held my interest even more because we were dealing with a social design, real lives, real people working out human problems. And I think this is one of the great advantages of anthropology. Some people think of anthropology as dedicated to the disenfranchised. You know, we're all going to think happy thoughts about the Hopi today. But it's really a technique for seeing ourselves, for holding up the mirror. And I think it's become particularly important today because with this retribalization under the electronic media, we have models before us, if not exact models to follow, at least the closest models we have of social design that has been worked out and does operate, not an imaginary thing, not some utopian effort, but something that's been weathered and eroded and worked over centuries. You know, when the cave paintings, the Ignatian and Magdalenian cave paintings of Europe were first discovered, they weren't understood. It was assumed that these were the interesting efforts of men who were not yet fully human. And it took artists like Arp and Brock and others to explain to us what was involved there. Now, in a way, we've reversed the process. Now we ask the native to explain us to ourselves. I sometimes tell my students in Southern California that the closest experience I know to Eskimo life is life in the San Fernando Valley. And they think I'm joking, but I'm not. You know, when you're in the Arctic, you don't live within a container. You're not in space and you're not in time. These things are in you. You often can't tell the difference between the ground and the sky, and when the wind rises and the snow fills the air, you're inside a great white cauldron. You're blind, but you're blind white, not blind black. And the only thing that exists suddenly is yourself, and you become a data processor. You have to smell, and you have to feel that wind, and you have to watch the way the wind cuts into that snowbank, because if you don't, you're lost. And if you're lost, you're dead. And with that wind changing and the environment changing, you have to constantly adjust to a dynamic universe. And the same is true in time. The winter is totally dark, and the summer is totally light, and the wind will change everything. And you suddenly realize that the only reality that exists happens to be yourself, and that you are moving through this amorphous, changeless, changing environment. Now, in many ways, this is what life has become in Southern California, and they call it a window on the future. I presume it will be the whole of America. It isn't that it's cold there, and it isn't that there's hunger, and it isn't that there's a shortage of things for the eye or the senses to cling to. There's just too much. There's never to end too much of things, which has the same effect. And as you move through that environment, suddenly you find that the only thing that exists happens to be yourself. And I think that we can turn then to the native and find out what he's made of his world and how he makes it, how he creates a particular somewhere, how he gives definition to himself, and how often he turns inward, not in the quest for adjustment to an outer reality, but the search for insight. As I watched the young people in California change, it's fascinating. The Beat, you know, rejected everything. He was the answer to Ronald Reagan. Reagan said, you know, take everything. It's good because it's American-made. It's consumer. It's the better homes and gardens sort of thing. Two cars, spin dryer, the works. And the Beat said no, he didn't want any of it. It wasn't even going to wash. And then along came the hippie, and the hippie said, you know, some things are good and some things are bad. He started to select. He said hi-fi's good. It's electronic. It links people. Luxury goods are bad. They divide people. Incidentally, they've given up the search for the hunt against communists in California. Now they're after the anti-consumer, the non-consumer. He's the real threat, and they've caught a few of them. I've noticed another change that's taking place. The hippie fell into the same trap as the Beat. He thought that to be primitive was to a lack of concern with the body. And of course, this isn't true. Native peoples are most interested in body etiquette. The harsher the landscape, the more demanding the environment, the more they will deny their nothingness by using the human body as art form. They, more than anyone else, even more than the American female, will treat themselves as art form. And this is now beginning to come in. And incidentally, automobiles now are being treated as art forms. The psychedelic Volkswagen, I taught a class this last spring, about 400 students, and I entered from the back, and the hair, I had one girl who had a fluorescent green hairdo. That was marvelous. And you could tell, they'd spend, you know, 2-3 hours on this sort of thing. And this was art. It was design. And a number of other things. Anyway, to be very brief, I think that we will. I'd like, insofar as I will be working in the course, to turn to the native to see what he makes of that world, and then perhaps compare it to our own. Let me end on one request: that you go and see the movie Bonnie and Clyde. See it. We'll be talking about it.
My concerns, which I'll just deal with briefly here. One of the nice things about this year, if you don't mind reading mail, is that we sort of have hundreds of letters over in the office there of people who want to be sitting where you're sitting, or of people who'd like to come and work with us. So that in addition to Dr. McLuhan and Dr. Carpenter and Professor Parker, there are a number of other people, Tony Schwartz, whom Harley mentioned before, just has to be the best guy working in sound in the country these days. And we have a filmmaker who will be coming in January. But we would like to take the ideas that we're probing here and put them into some kind of usable form. One very interesting idea that a number of us are interested in is planning a school system. Say, all right, you know, we all walked through that other one. Now, look what it did to us. Let's see whether we can't help the next generation. And decide, what kids might learn and when they might learn it, and what a three-year-old should start to do to tune up his sensorium before just taking the existing things and trying to do them better. Another interesting idea, there's a lot of interest in these days, is the whole idea that as literacy was the skill to which these schools have been dedicated in the past, that now something we might call mediacy, which is a set of percepts about all media, that if you live in a multimedia environment, you just have to have a multimedia kind of skull, and that the idea that we should pay serious attention to all of the arts and all of the media as we have paid almost exclusive attention to print in the past. When Marshall was mentioning the Negro in revolt against an environment and a media system that rejected him, it's very interesting to see some of the projects that people have been involved with in using the newer media with these people who are much more oral. Some of the, Tony Schwartz, for instance, has done some sound work with dropout kids, which he says there aren't five people in the United States could do these days. And these are kids that have just been pushed out and dropped out of everything in sight. So over the next couple of weeks, as we throw out topic sentences, I'd like you to start picking them up on the first or second bounce and kind of pick a practical area where you'd have some concern, whether it be popular music, the multimedia environment. Somebody could do a term paper on the cheetah. That'd be fine. They could be the student in residence at the cheetah or something like that. But I think, again, it's the ideas, not just ideas that are culturally respectable according to the old categories or levels of tolerance that the elite culture will allow, but what are the ideas that are relevant? If there is a generation gap, not just between parents and kids, but between kids in the same family, that's an interesting one. Nobody's paid much attention to that one. So if there's some area at which plugging in would make anything we do more relevant to you, it's your move to decide that and to take any of your reading and seminar work and things like that and push it in that direction. Thus ends first meeting, CA 141. Thank you.
So that was the opening lecture for McLuhan's fateful year at Fordham. Within 2 months, he is in the hospital for the longest brain surgery in the history of humanity known, 21 and a half hours or so. That puts him out of action for a few weeks or something, and then he entertains people at his home out in Bronxville with his neighbor Jack Parr, the famous talk show at that time, talk show host. And then he gets back into Fordham and does some more teaching and lectures, and then he goes back to a Canada that enters a new phase with a charismatic Prime Minister Trudeau, which McLuhan was a friend, became a friend of. So I've never heard that before. That's an interesting statement of the course content that went on to bankrupt Fordham University that year, because, as you heard reference, the state, New York State, withdrew the $100,000 assigned to McLuhan because it was a private university, and they're not going to help. No, that wasn't the reason. It was, it wasn't designed to help anybody coming from another country, I think. It's the fact that McLuhan was Canadian. So Fordham had to come up with the money on their own, and I met Edward Wakin. That would be 30 years later in 1998, and he told me the university never recovered from the debt accumulated by McLuhan's term year there.